Thank you, Mike. We just had in our hearing Titus chapter 2. Our lesson tonight comes from the book of Titus. Coincidentally, but that is good. In Titus chapter 1, verse 5, Paul exhorts Titus. He says, I've left you in Crete that you should set in order the things that are wanting. And we often attach that to the next few verses. The next few verses talk about some additional qualifications for elders. Not as extensive as what we have in 1 Timothy 3, but additional and maybe giving us a better clarity. As I've studied and thought about the book of Titus, however, I wonder if that's all that comes under the heading of set things in order. We need to remember that for the first 1,000 years of the New Testament, there were no chapter breaks. For the first 1,500 years of the New Testament, there were no verse breaks. And I'm glad we have chapter and verse breaks because we can turn to a certain place and we're all there rather quickly. But I think it sometimes causes us to disjoint some thoughts just because it starts a new chapter. And I'm wondering, as I study Titus, if the concept of setting things in order certainly does apply to officers there in those following verses, but applies to maybe the rest of the book. And I'd like to at least approach it from that standpoint a little bit tonight. Because it interests me, and chapter 2 is where I really want to plant my flag tonight, but just looking at chapter 1, once we get through verse 9, which are some additional thoughts on responsibilities and qualifications for elders, he goes right in the next 7 verses to a discussion of false teachers. Now, why would he do that? Well, I wonder if what he's maybe telling us, and I'm convinced of this because of verse 9, is one of the reasons it's important to have good, godly elders is to be able to confront and handle teaching that's incorrect. Now, if we have a congregation that does not have elders and we have pillars in that congregation, I hope they would resist it too, but that is one of the important jobs, not the only one. I don't know if it's the most, but I don't know how to rank them, of elders. So part of this setting things in order is dealing with false teachers when they come in. You know, it's one thing to reprimand a false teacher that we don't know very well. But it's much harder, I think, in my experience and observations, to deal with a false teacher that we're very close to. Sometimes they might be a member of our family, a friend, a brother and sister in the Lord that we've worshiped with for decades. And it becomes very, very painful. But Paul doesn't tell Titus only deal with the false teachers that it's easy to deal with, does he? No. He gives a rather comprehensive statement. A false teacher, no matter how close they might be to us, has to be confronted. That was true in the Old Testament. We find it here true in the book of Titus. He says in verse 10, for there are many unruly and vain talk, rebellious people. That would be a good way, I think, of summing up verse 10. There's going to be rebellious people sometimes in a group. And one of the reasons that we're so blessed when we do have, and why it's so needful that we do have, good leaders in our congregation are to deal with that. I don't think these false teachers necessarily were individuals that had never accepted the Lord. I don't think they were necessarily people that did not believe in God. There's a passage in the Bible that talks about false teachers, and it says they deceive others, but they also deceive themselves. I think many false teachers are very, very sincere because they have deceived themselves. And Paul puts a tremendous emphasis here in the latter part. In fact, he spends more verses, if you're going to count, on false teachers in this first chapter than he does on the qualifications for elders. Now, he had obviously written to Timothy and given us more on the qualifications of elders. But it's all part of setting things in order. Now I want to go to chapter 2, and I know that was a very quick surfing over, but I will slow down and probably won't get much past the first 4 or 5 verses of Titus chapter 2. But I want you to keep in mind that thought of still setting things in order. We've got elders to be appointed. We've got false teachers here at Crete to be taken care of. And now we kind of internalize and go inside the congregation, and we're going to have different groups within the congregation addressed and instruction given on how to help one another. In Titus chapter 2, he has responsibilities for all of us. The older men, the older women, the younger women, the free and the slave. And we all in some form fall into each of those categories. I believe what the first part of this second chapter has to do with setting things in order is that Paul is telling Titus a healthy church requires a healthy home. And healthy homes require healthy teaching. So he's given instructions. It's been a decade, and time gets away from me, and it may have been 2 decades. I call Titus chapter 2 the AT&T chapter. And the reason I call it the AT&T chapter, 10 or 15 years ago, there was a commercial that AT&T did. They were in the midst of being castigated by the government for being overly a monopoly. So they broke it up, and now it's coming back together, and I don't know which is best. It really doesn't matter, but they came up with a rather clever advertising slogan, reach out and touch someone. I'm just looking at how many faces never heard that before and feeling a little old. But trust me, you'll read about it in the history books, kids. Reach out and touch someone. And I wonder if that's not a pretty good theme for the first few verses in Titus chapter 2. Or maybe I could just play on that a little bit and say, reach out and teach someone. But teaching someone in a Christian sense and touching them in a Christian sense are really almost synonymous, aren't they? Paul instructs Titus to reach out to every group in the church and challenge them to a holy lifestyle. Lifestyles that would present themselves as the salt of the earth and the light of the world. But I think he goes further than that and says, Titus, if the Christians in Crete, and I think that applies to us, don't pass along what they have learned, then they have failed. And I believe that's true of me, and maybe you could consider that being somewhat true of you. We all have different talents, but we can all teach because there are so many different forms of teaching. If we don't pass along some of the wonderful things the Lord has taught us, how can we be considered successful or pleasing unto the Lord? In 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 15 and 16, and again in chapter 2, verse 9, we are called to holiness. I believe holiness is to be the everyday business of every Christian. It's to show itself in our decisions, and I talked a little bit about that this morning. It's to show itself in the things we do, hour by hour, day by day, minute by minute. And holiness is to change us. But not only can it change us, holiness within us can change those around us by its influence. I believe everybody here is a leader. We've got only 2 elders. We've got 6 deacons, 2 evangelists. But I believe everybody here is a leader, not in the same sense. I believe there are great leaders. I believe there are good leaders. I believe there are bad leaders. But you're a leader. The choice is simply you want to be a great one, a good one, or a bad one. Titus is being exhorted to exhort these brethren at Crete to be good leaders, if not great. If we are not pursuing holiness, then I guess there must be a good chance we're not the children of God. Now, I'm going to go down through four or five verses here, and each one of these little segments, you know, could be a lesson in and of itself, and some of you have probably given lessons on this. I'm going to take a little quicker, more rapid-fire overview of this, but I want us to get the essence of it. Let me reread, not because it wasn't read well, but just to refresh our minds, the first two verses of Titus chapter 2. But speak you the things which become sound doctrine. In other words, spew forth the truth. That the aged men be sober, grave, temperate, sound in faith, in charity, and in patience. And we sometimes, because we don't really know where to put the line, kind of joke about, well, who's old and who isn't. I don't really care. Let's call it experienced men, if you're more comfortable with that. I remember when this congregation started, if I remember right, our oldest member was like 53 or 54. But we've come right along, and that's no longer the case. And I remember at the time thinking, missing the gray hairs. And I would sometimes go to other congregations, and Smart Road was a new congregation, and they would be curious, and they would ask about it. And I would make a comment about our oldest member was younger than their youngest member in some cases. And they would be somewhat envious. I didn't necessarily feel that way, because I felt we missed some of the maturity and the experience that comes only with age. And I'm glad we've been able to develop that, hopefully. It's been said that America is now the oldest society in the history of the world. And by that, it doesn't mean that we have people living 800-900 years like we find in the book of Genesis, but on a percentage basis, we have more senior citizens, as we define them, than we have teenagers now, and that is a relative rarity. And it has an impact on the church, and it has an impact on the family. I believe getting older should be enjoyed as much as possible. We do, as we age, sometimes become creatures of almost unbreakable habits, and that's not always good, but sometimes it is. We could allow sin to be so woven into the fabric of our lives that it's almost impossible to move it. But I believe Paul understood the great value of mature Christians when he talks in verse 2 and 3 about the mature men, the mature women. Let me go down. I just want to make a few comments on each one of these, and we'll move through them rather rapidly. I'm in the King James Version, which says the aged men, they should be sober, temperate, some translations use. They're to be clear-headed. If you go back and look at the history of Crete, it's been said the national pastime of Crete was intoxication. I don't think the word sober here necessarily is dealing with that, although drunkenness is condemned in the scriptures. But this carries with it the idea of being clear-headed. They are to be grave, means they're to be dignified. I think Paul is talking to the older men, and some of us fit into that category. I don't know where that line is. I don't really care, because it hopefully will apply to all of us before we die. But it doesn't mean that they're to be boring, gloomy. But it does mean they're not to be overly frivolous, not to be overly flippant. They've gotten to the age where the feeling of invincibility begins to wane. You get to the age where you look down the road and maybe 20 years, barring something unforeseen, is really all you've got left. Maybe 25, maybe 30, but you're well past the 50 percentile of your life. You've buried your parents in many cases. You sometimes have buried brothers and sisters. Some even have buried sons and daughters. They've stood in the hospital waiting rooms today while a loved one died. They've waited for the surgeon to come out and explain what's next. They've watched children, maybe grandchildren, be born, only to turn away from the faith. Must be one of the most heartbreaking things for a parent. They've seen so much. They've felt so much. They've borne burdens and experiences. And they're changed. They're changed. And in a Christian sense, hopefully changed for the good. He says they're to be temperate. Really, this means to be sensible in your character. To be discreet. To be discerning. Not to fall for the most recent excitement. Those are the things that come with age. They've gone through experiences. They've developed a strength of mind and a depth of experience that is invaluable to a group of Christians that we call a congregation. They're to be sound in faith. Hold fast to the landmarks they've been given. To do it in love, in charity, in patience, which really carries the idea here of endurance. It's the hanging in there, people. You know, I often go to congregations, and believe it or not, I might be the youngest one in the assembly. That's not common, but it does happen. And I'll see two older brethren, maybe at the back of the door, shaking hands. And they're well into their 80s, if not older. And I wonder to myself, how many years have those two steadfast brethren stood for the Lord? That handshake means more than it's good to see you today. That handshake, I think, represents years of enduring. Or I'll see an older sister walk down the aisle, because they often sit toward the front, and pat a younger person on the shoulder as if they're saying, you know, hang in there. I know what some of the things you're going to endure. What a contrast to the society around us. Those of us, or those of you that don't consider yourself in this category, let me just say that we all need to remember that the aged within our groups have so much to offer. Proverbs talks about honoring the hoary or the white head of the aged. Sure, things change. Hearing fades. Memories fade. Our gait slows down. But don't you find it so encouraging when people older than you come, when you know maybe they don't really feel like it, they come because of their commitment to the group and their commitment to the Lord? Oh, may that be all of us if God graces us with years. But I remember talking to an older elder a couple of years ago in another state, and he's still an elder. He's almost 90 now. And we were talking about the aging process, and I was kind of mentally taking notes, knowing that I wasn't that far behind him. And he said, you know, one of the things that happens as you get a little older is you start losing your confidence. You begin wondering, can I still do it in the service of the Lord? Well, I think that's an awfully important place for those of us that are younger to use our encouraging skills, because we need them so much. Yes, maybe they can't recall every verse. Maybe they can't stand and run and walk as long as they used to, but oh, those life experiences teach us so much. And I would also encourage us, as we get older, not to be tempted to hang up the shingle. I believe the Lord places a great amount of honor on people that serve Him to the end. And I could mention a lot of people here, and or in the brotherhood, and I don't need to, but one that really kind of stands out just because of his obvious feebleness. And I was with him a couple of weeks ago, and he's been here, and that's Brother Tom Dennis. And Tom has been frail physically for a long time. And when he comes up, at least when I'm seeing him up the steps to the pulpit, you wonder if he's going to make it. Well, I saw him a couple of weeks ago, and he's not only now teetery coming up to the pulpit, he's teetery walking on the flat surfaces. But I believe he's a great example of someone that's going to do it until they can't possibly do it anymore. And oh, I admire that. Do I admire every facet of him? Probably not, any more than he admires every facet of me. But that's good stuff. That's the Caleb type stuff that we find in Numbers chapter 14. That's the kind of stuff that I want to be made of. That's the kind of stuff we want to be made of, I think. But now I have to move on because you ladies will be offended if I don't get to you. The aged women, verse 3, likewise, that they be in behavior as becometh holiness, not false accusers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things. Tyler, Texas, little cemetery on the outskirts of Tyler, Texas, has a tombstone that reads as follows. Mahilita, wife of R. Atkins, she was the sunshine of our home. That's all. Ladies, isn't that the way you want to be remembered? Wouldn't that be wonderful if every lady here, her family, as they rise up and call her blessed, could stand at her funeral and say, she was the sunshine of our home. Well, I think that's what Paul is exhorting Titus to instill. Look at some of the things he says. That they have behavior as becometh holiness. We already talked about that. Not false accusers. There's a couple here in verse 3 that I just wonder, and I don't have the answer to my own wonderment, why they're for the women here rather than the men, because they're obviously important for both, but maybe this false accusers has a little bit to do with the loquaciousness of some women. I don't know. I truly don't know for sure why he says the women should not be given to much wine when he didn't include that for the men. We know that men are not to also. That's one of the qualifications of an elder. But maybe time on our hands, maybe, dare I say, boredom in the home for some of these ladies was more of a problem for that. I don't know. But he's talking about behavior and conduct. But then notice, ladies, teachers of good things. To be teachers of good things. Who are you and I reaching out to touch? Who are we reaching out to teach? We're exhorted here to be teachers of good things. And that doesn't happen coincidentally. It does not happen without effort. In verse 4, they're to teach the younger women to be sober, to be grave, to be sensible, not flighty, to love their husbands, to love their children. You know, the Bible, many, many places tells husbands to love their wives. This is one of the very few, if not almost the only place in scriptures where wives are told to love their husbands. I bet it's a 10-to-1 ratio. I bet for every one time women are told to love their husbands, the New Testament tells husbands to love their wives 10 times. I don't know the answer to my wonderment. It doesn't keep me from having an opinion, which I will share. But I want to differentiate opinion from Scripture. I think women more naturally love than men. And maybe the Lord in his wisdom felt, ladies, he didn't have to remind you of that as much as he did we men. We men have our strengths, but that's not always one of them. Not that we don't love you, but we don't show it in ways that are as obvious as maybe they ought to be. Teach the young women to love their children. There must have been a time when people just scratched their head at that. But you just turn on the news now and see some of the things going on, and it amazes us all, doesn't it, how especially a mother could do that to their children. It's bad if a father does it, but there's just something about that maternal bond that even for the world is hard for them to absorb. But they were having to be taught this, or they were told to teach them to do this. How important that is, to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home doesn't carry necessarily the thought of being homekeepers, although housekeepers, having our homes neat and tidy is probably a good thing, if not a Christian thing. And if it weren't for you ladies, there would be a lot of more clutter than there is in our homes. I don't think that means a woman should not work outside of the home. I do think it's a prioritization of the home should come first. I'm reminded also of what Paul says to Timothy in 1 Timothy 5. If a man does not provide for his own, he is worse than an atheist. King James says infidel, but that's the same thing. To be discreet, to be sensible, to be self-controlled, to be chaste, to be pure, to be good, to be obedient to their own husbands. Some of you, not all of you, but some of you have performed wedding ceremonies. And there used to be a phrase that was just awfully common in wedding ceremonies, to love and obey, something along that lines. What would you do if you were asked to perform a marriage ceremony and they didn't want obey in it? What would you do? It happens. I was watching the news. I think it was the debate. I didn't watch very much of it, but I watched as much as that I could. And Thursday night, the Iowa debate, whichever night that was. And a reporter, it was a gotcha question. And Michelle Bachmann, I don't care what you think of her. I just was interested in this one thing. She had made the statement that she submits to her husband. And so they asked her, what does that mean? And it was a gotcha question. And she paused for a minute. I liked her answer. She said that in our relationship, that means we have great respect one for another. And I think that's what Paul is talking about in Ephesians chapter 5. He's not talking about Archie Bunker. He's talking about respect and honor. Christian women are to convey that image. Reach out and touch someone. How are our young ladies going to learn? And many of them have learned, which tells me that there's a lot of reaching out and teaching. So this is not a condemnation. This is an encouragement, maybe, for us to maybe do a little more, or maybe just to keep up the good work. Again, I think Paul is saying Crete will not be right until the church is right, and the church will not be right until the home is right. I believe I could say that for our nation. America will not be right until the church is right, and the church will not be right until the home is right. God gave us three wonderful institutions: the home, the church, and civil government. But which one did he give us first? The home, because the other two depend upon it. And that's why probably we're unable to solve some of our problems. But be that as it may, we in the church, we as Christians can do what's right. Everybody else can choose to do what's wrong, but you don't have to, and I don't have to. That's the wonderful thing about God's plan. To have good moral sense. In the Netherlands, there's a tradition, and I don't know how strictly this is adhered to anymore, but I liked it. It was the custom in the Netherlands that when a newlywed couple entered their house, they would enter it through a special door. And when they entered it after their wedding, that door was sealed up. And it was never opened again until one of them left in death. And that whole tradition was symbolic of how that relationship, marriages, and homes are to be so solid. I don't know that they were doing it out of spiritual reasons, but I believe what they were doing had a biblical setting. You ladies do so much for us. I could extol you for another hour, but then some of you would quit listening for sure, and others of you would have heads that would challenge the doors as you leave. And I don't want either one to happen. But I did run across a little incident that brought memories back to me. It was in arithmetic class. Sounds to me like it was like fifth, sixth grade, if I kind of remember what we were doing then. It was one of these story problems. And the teacher went to a little boy and said, "Suppose your mother made a peach pie, and there were 10 of you at the table. How much of the pie would you get?" And he thought for a minute, and he said, 1/9. And she thought, boy, we're not getting very far. So she went through it again. He said, 1/9. She said, "You don't know your fractions, do you?" She said, "You don't know my mom. You don't know my mom." I've shared this with you, and I don't know if you'll remember it. She's here tonight. It's a little embarrassing for me to tell you how old I was before I didn't realize the neck and the back were the good pieces of the chicken, because that's what mom always took. Teaching the younger women to love their children. The Bible teaches us so much, and we have such a task to pass it on. Ladies, you've got a unique role because we men are interesting creatures. You are too, but I'm on with you right now. Someone once said, "Man does not live by bread alone, but he sure does need a little buttering up every once in a while." Women need men to know that we love them. And ladies, your husbands and the men in your life need to know that you respect them. And I've never had to counsel a couple because they were breaking up if they loved and respected one another. I don't think it's possible. They may think they do, but with those two pillars in a congregation, in a home, in a family, I don't know how you can not succeed. "For this cause I left you in Crete, that you should have set in order the things that are wanting." Yes, ordain elders in every city, as I have appointed you. But I can't help but think that part of the setting of things in order in the churches at Crete was not simply the appointment of their officers. Important. It was the protection of them from false teachers, and it was the passing along that we see here in Titus chapter 2 of these wonderful things to the next generation. I think probably all of us that have lived over half of our lives certainly pray that this next generation does better than we've done. I don't say that to say that I think we have done terrible. We just always want what's a little better for the next group. And I, in many facets, see a group coming on that may well be able to do that. Time will tell. But I'm certainly not pessimistic about it. But I know those of us that have lived a few more decades in a way that is loving, have an opportunity and a responsibility to pass along what we have learned. And those of you that are younger, I believe, have a responsibility for accepting it as best you can. Think of the people that have meant the most to you as you were growing in your Christian faith that maybe are gone now. Maybe they're gone now. Some of them certainly are, in my case. And don't you sometimes long to go back and have time and you wish you could ask them what you didn't ask them? Well, now's the time. Reach out and touch somebody. They don't have to be in your own family. Just someone you can pass along, something that maybe will help them a little bit. Because I have great fondness and appreciation for those who took the time to do it with me, even when I was not as receptive as I'm asking you to be at that age. We're going to close our thoughts tonight. Wonderful book. We didn't even get through half of it, and we skimmed through most of that. All part of setting things in order in our lives, in our homes, and in our churches. We're going to extend the gospel invitation. This is a very personal moment. It's a very private moment. It's between you and the Lord. It has nothing to do with me. It has nothing to do with people sitting around you. It's between you and God. If this is your time, then we would be privileged to be witnesses of that, but not really participants in it. Because salvation is very personal. You're not saved, and I'm not saved because we're here. We are saved because of what's in here. This is a very quiet, humbling time. But it's a time to put the fear of hell out of your life and put the joy of the Lord in its place. If we can help anybody in any way, we invite you to come as we stand and as we sing.